Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Well, it's been 17 years since we last heard this particular sound. And Jessica Ware, when you hear this, what goes through your mind?
Well, it definitely makes me think of summer. It definitely makes me think of warm weather. But it reminds me of grad school. I had just moved here to the United States from Canada. And we don't really have big periodical cicada emergences where I come from in Ontario. And my colleagues told me there are going to be trillions of insects emerging, trillions of cicadas. I honestly almost didn't believe them. And so when I hear this noise, it just reminds me of the wonder the first time I experienced one of these mass emergences of a brood.
Wonder is absolutely the word. And this is Jessica Ware, who is an associate curator in invertebrate zoology at the American Museum of Natural History. She's an entomologist. And today, she's going to introduce us to the wonder of the periodical cicada, specifically Brood 10, which is set to emerge or begin to emerge, what, any day, any week now, Jessica?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, we've all been kind of actively watching. There's an app that you can kind of track people when people are noticing different nymphs that are emerging. And we've all been kind of counting the minutes. We know that they were around the area where I live in New Jersey. They were out, you know, around May 13th in 2004. So I'm expecting them by then, but they might show up a couple of days early.
Okay. So many questions. And I've got a lot of questions for you. I know listeners probably do, too. So folks, hop over onto Twitter and Facebook. We're at On Point Radio. If you remember the last emergence of Brood 10 back in 2004-ish, share your stories. Love to hear them because we're going to be talking about Brood 10 this hour. So first of all, Jessica, is there a difference in the amount of interest people have this time around for this emergence versus 17 years ago?
I think people have always been kind of fascinated by these periodical cicada emergences. And the reason why we know this is because humans have been documenting it. Every time there's a massive emergence, especially Brood 10, which is one of the largest broods, you know, people write songs about it. Bob Dylan wrote a song about it in 1970 when he experienced it. But even early entomologists, you know, when the Northeast or the Eastern seaboard of the United States was colonized, you know, early entomologists made notes. Oh my goodness, there is this phenomenon where every 17 years, these insects come out. And so people have been documenting this in 1633, you know, Plymouth settlers documented, you know, when early Swedish entomologists came to visit from the 1740s, they documented it. So I think people have been fascinated for a long time. I think there's been hype each time.
Well, I mean, how could there not be, right? With trillions of insects or larval stage insects emerging from the ground virtually at once. Can you tell me a little bit more about the 17th century entomologists who observed it? I imagine that they thought it was some sort of biblical event almost.
Yeah, it's funny. Many of those early writings, they do tend to refer to these insects as locust-like, as if it was a locust swarm. But of course, these insects are really have a very different life history strategy than locusts, and they're not eating our crops. They're actually not harming really anything about the human condition other than being slightly, I guess, annoying if you have to shovel them up if they're in your garden. But that was the phrase that a lot of these early entomologists used, was that they were these plagues. But of course, I don't see this as a plague. I see it as a celebration.
Yeah. Okay. So let's get some sort of some just specific scientific information out about Brood 10. First of all, cicadas aren't locusts. So how would you define what they are?
So all cicadas are members of this order of insects. So insects are kind of divided up into these different groups called orders. And the order Hemiptera is the order to which cicadas belong. And this particular brood that we have coming out right now, brood 10, is comprised of a genus that has three, there's three different species in Magicicada that are coming out together, and together they form brood 10. So these are true bugs. The Hemiptera are true bugs. Not all insects are bugs, but all bugs are insects. It's one of those types of things. And these true bugs all have these sucking mouth parts. And that's what these cicadas are going to be doing is just like the other the stink bugs are members of Hemiptera, bed bugs are members of Hemiptera. There are many things that we encounter in the summer that are also, you know, members of Hemiptera that are close relatives of cicadas.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit in more detail about the three species particular to brood 10. And please forgive me if I pronounce them incorrectly, but I have here Magicicada septendecim. Is that one of them? Okay. Yeah. Called the Ferrocicada. And we have a little sound of or a little bit of a clip of the sound that it makes. So here's the Ferrocicada. So making a sound that sounds like Pharaoh. So tell me a little bit more about this particular species.
Well, I mean, this species is actually very similar to the other three species in a lot of ways, although they are slightly different in their call. So that pharaoh call that you hear for septendecim, you don't hear that same noise for the decula and for the dwarf, the other two species that are in this brood.
Okay, so is the Magicicada Cassini?
Did I say yeah, sure.
Sure is not good enough. How do you say it?
I would say Cassini.
Cassini. Okay, well, it's got two eyes, of course. Magicicada Cassini. Here's its courting calls. And how is it that they're making the call, the sound?
So this sounds so different to my ears, this quick burst and rapid clicks. And those are basically formed the same way that the pharaoh is forming a song, with these timbal muscles, these timbal organs that males have that allows this kind of vibration, the vibration that can vary in pattern and pulse and length. See that click, 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 that sound, that's classic Cassini.
Okay. How are they making that vibration? Through what part of their body?
So on their abdomen, males have a structure called the timbal organ, and there's muscles that are kind of attached to it that allow them to kind of pull on this organ, and that's what causes the vibration, and that's what that's the sound that we're hearing.
Okay, and the third one, Magicicada septendecula, and it's the rarest, and here's its sound. They all sound so different. They really do. Tell us about septendecula.
Yeah, so this tick, 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 tick sound, that's a very classic septendecula sound. And as adults, you can see the slight variation in the color and their slight morphological characteristics or the overall appearance that are different. The nymphs look pretty similar, although there are some subtle differences as well in the color between the three.
So why then do these cicadas only emerge every 17 years?
Well, this is a question for the ages, right? So there are researchers who have devoted their whole lives to really trying to answer this question, including Gene Kritsky and Chris Simon. But basically, one hypothesis is that these are prime numbers when these periodical cicadas are coming out, 13 years, 17 years. And it's possible this is an anti-predator strategy. Maybe it's harder for predators to kind of predict these mass emergences when these numbers are, you know, 17, when they're prime numbers.
Hang on here for a second. I just want to pause for a moment and say, how amazing is that? Okay. Because prime numbers, you would think, would be something that would really be only meaningful in the human mind, but I guess that's the, you know, math is one of the languages of Mother Nature. But what is it about prime numbers that would make it hard for predators to know when the cicada are going to emerge?
Well, I mean, I think it's none of these organisms that we're talking about are necessarily very good at math per se, but they're picking up on these environmental cues, and timing is playing a part of that. But when the numbers are prime numbers, it's more difficult to kind of predict. Whether every other year would be a very easy thing to predict. Every year would be a very easy thing to predict. But when it's an odd number, when it's a prime number, especially, gosh, I can remember learning about prime numbers in elementary school and thinking, I'll never have to know this. But of course we do if we're studying insects. And so what we think is happening is this, it allows these insects to kind of emerge in this mass emergence on either 13 or 17 years, these prime numbers. And then it's a satiation strategy. You know, so in part, predators have so much food to consume that the chances that an individual cicada, Bob, will survive to be able to pass his genes on to the next generation is pretty good, because chances are good all of the cicadas around Bob are going to be consumed. And it's also, one hypothesis is that it's a competitor exclusion strategy where, you know, you can really outcompete all of the other types of insects that are competing for that resource of space or food or whatever it is that you're competing for when there's so many of you, when you're such vast numbers.
Right. When you come out in the trillions, literally. Yeah. So kind of a saturation. Oh, you were going to correct me?
No. That's right. Yeah. It's a saturation strategy.
Okay. And so, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. When there are trillions of you, the survival of the species as a whole seems pretty good. But what is happening? Oh, my gosh. Look, we're already out of time for this first segment here. So let me just ask a quick question here from we're getting a lot of questions online. A listener wants to know, they're in Connecticut. Will they be able to see the Brood 10 emergence in Connecticut? Do you know?
Yeah, I don't think that you're going to see Brood 10 in Connecticut, unfortunately, but you could take a short drive down to New Jersey and you'll see quite a few.
Okay, well, someone else, Aaron Fody, says, here in Massachusetts, finally planned a family trip after a hard year. Yay, we're going to the beach in South Delaware, Memorial Day weekend. Is Aaron going to be hanging out with the bugs in South Delaware?
If you're lucky, Aaron, you will. I think you will.
I'm not sure Aaron will see that as luck, but it won't happen for another 17 years, Aaron. So it is lucky. We are talking about Brood 10, the 17-year periodical cicada. We'll have more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
The bugs are coming. Billions of bugs. The periodic cicada invasion is just days away in many states.
Billions, if not trillions, of tiny invaders will begin their assault on nearly all of the country east of the Mississippi River.
These large, loud, obnoxious insects will be flying and crawling around by the millions.
No. I hang my head in shame in terms of how the media sometimes talks about the wonders of Mother Nature. So we are going to get the scientific view of the beauty of the emergence of Brood 10, the periodical cicada that we will be seeing in the eastern and midwestern United States any day now. I'm joined today by Jessica Ware. She's an entomologist and associate curator in invertebrate zoology at the American Museum of Natural History. And Jessica, let me just ask you really quickly. I don't. Your response to how some in the media talk about the quote unquote invasion of the periodical cicada, it seems all wrong to me.
Yeah, it makes me feel some dismay, to be honest, because I mean, from an entomological perspective, of course, this is an amazing phenomenon. It's a biological phenomenon that's actually very interesting when you think about how this could have evolved over the last 500, you know, 1,000 years or so. But then also when we use words like attack, invasion, swarm, you know, it makes people think of danger. When, of course, these cicadas are not dangerous to humans at all. They don't bite. They don't sting. They're a great food source for us, for our cats, for our dogs, for the birds in our garden. I mean, the noise, sure, it's a little loud, but it's a beautiful song. I think there's way more positive things one could say about cicadas than the small minor nuisance that people might experience when, you know, just by there being so many of them in their yard.
Well, there's also something very human about initially reacting to the sort of massive demonstrations of the wonders of nature with a sense of not awe, which is what we should have, but sort of fear and foreignness, I think. And it'd be wonderful for us as a species to get past that. I am going to editorialize on that. But you talked about food. Hold that thought for a second, because we're going to come back to it. But on the question of danger, we have more comments coming in on social media about the Brood 10 cicada, which are going to emerge any day now. And Jake Barrett wants to know, how does Brood 10's emergence impact other flora and fauna in regions where they emerge? Does it decimate plant life, or does it help promote new vegetation?
Well, I mean, the adults, so remember, these cicadas have been around for a long time. They're older than my daughter, who just turned 16. So they've been actually feeding on the trees from which they're going to be emerging for the last 17 years, drinking the xylem, drinking the sap, you know, from inside the trees. And so when they emerge, what they're actually doing is, you know, once they find a mate and they do the mating process, they actually will die and decompose. And that nutrition goes right into the soil, sometimes to the very trees from which they had been feeding for the last 17 years. So it can be a real boon to your garden, having this extra nutritional kind of deposit that comes from, you know, trillions of cicadas dying.
Wait, so can we just talk about how amazing that is? So basically trees and forests are the subsurface world of those trees and forests. The root system is what the cicadas spend 99.9% of their life cycle feeding off of.
Yeah. So it's kind of remarkable to think about. They start out as, you know, the size of about a grain of rice. And they, you know, when they emerge from the egg, they drop down to the soil. They do a series of molts. So insects will kind of molt to a larger, what's called instar, or a larger life stage. And they're just consuming xylem, you know, pooping, drinking, pooping, and then they'll molt the next instar. And then on the last molt, they'll actually molt to an adult. So that whole 99% of the time, like you mentioned, is underground feeding. They're alive underground. They're feeding. They're growing.
Jessica, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay, good. They're feeding and they're growing. The xylem again is what? Is it tree sap? I mean, what do we call? How do we understand what xylem?
Yeah, that's a good way to think of it. You know, the fluids that are inside of trees. We love tree sap. I love tree sap as a Canadian. And so I can get why the cicadas would be feeding on it. It's a good energy source.
Isn't that amazing? So essentially we can see that, like, we're feeding off of the same stuff that the cicada are. Oh my God. Okay. I love this. Okay. So food. Let's talk a little bit more about food, but from a different perspective here, because the last time that Brood 10 emerged, again, was 2004. And at that time, Jenna Jaden was a PhD student in evolutionary biology and ecology at the University of Maryland. And again, back in 2004, a well-known cicada expert, Mike Raup, a professor at the University of Maryland, he was inundated with press calls about the cicada emergence.
So he created a class for graduate students who are interested in doing public science outreach, i.e. helping him take on the press and deal with the cicadas.
So Jenna enrolled, and the class gave her an idea.
I thought, okay, I'm going to amuse Mike and I'm going to make a cookbook. So my thought with the cookbook was, well, this is a really good way to demystify these insects that everyone finds very frightening because they come out in thousands and they're everywhere and they run into you. And if we can say, haha, you know, look at this little picture of an insect in a Kiss the Cook apron and look at these recipes, we can just grab these things and eat them. It's a way to experience nature for yourself, with your family, but it's also a way to say, okay, you know, if they're that easy to catch and that easy to cook and we have this sort of quote power over them, you know, maybe they're not so scary. Maybe there's something we can enjoy and appreciate, and we can learn something about this wonderful natural phenomenon that happens only in the eastern coast of the U.S. We are constantly talking about how by 2050 there's going to be 9 billion people in the world. We need to figure out as a people what we are going to do to sustain that kind of population. You know, there's no one solution to that, and certainly eating insects is not the solution, but it is one of the solutions. They take much less water to grow than any other kind of livestock. Their food stock to protein conversion rate, which means like how much food do you give them and then how much protein do they pull out of it? They're about 8 to 12 times more efficient than cattle. They're about 6 to 8 times more efficient than goats and sheep and pigs. They're twice as efficient as poultry. They emit less methane. They emit less ammonia. So they are overall, if we need to get animal protein or just good protein, insects are really like a really climate-friendly choice. I'm looking through the recipes again now. My favorite, and I think it says this in the end, my favorite, very simple, very tasty, are chocolate-covered cicadas. I would say start going out in the evenings about now or in a week from now and see if you can find the grubs, catch the grubs. When they start coming out, they will be coming out in large numbers, usually. Get them, put them in a bag, freeze them gently to sleep. When you're about to use them, quickly blanch them just to get any potential soil bacteria or fungus or whatever is on them off of them. And then what you do is you take them and put them on a pan in the oven. I would recommend on top of parchment paper. You roast them for about 15 minutes at 225 degrees Fahrenheit. Ideally, what you want them to do is sort of harden up and dry out. And then they sort of have almost a soft nut kind of texture and taste. And then meanwhile, take whatever chocolate is your favorite. I'm a fan of melt chocolate, high quality melt chocolate, and melt it in a double boiler over low heat. And then you just take the cicadas out, you dip them in the chocolate, place on wax paper, and refrigerate until they're hardened.
A recipe there for chocolate-covered cicadas from Jenna Jaden, author of the cookbook Cicadalicious. Jenna's an evolutionary biologist who focuses on public science outreach. Jessica Ware, have you eaten cicada?
I've eaten a lot of different types of insects and annual cicadas, but I've never eaten periodical cicadas. So I'm really excited to have them this time around. So I went with a colleague, Joseph Yoon from Brooklyn Bugs, a couple of days ago, and we actually got some nymphs. I have 4 in my fridge right now, so I can prepare some. I don't know if I'll go for chocolate, though, Jenna. I think Jenna's recipe sounds delicious, but I'm more of a savory person. So I was thinking I might saute them and then just put them in with, you know, a stir fry.
And so for the annual cicadas that you have eaten, what do they taste like?
I personally found them to be very nutty in flavor. So I had them cooked in a pan and I found them to be very nutty. I know others have said that they thought they tasted very vegetable-like because they're basically just feeding on trees. Mm-hmm. But the way I had them prepared with a little paprika, it was very nutty flavor.
Yeah. You know, there are, of course, cultures around the world where actually insects are a not unusual part of the diet. And so I wonder, you heard Jenna talk in the middle of that that piece a little bit about how important it will be actually for humankind to consider insect protein as a more primary source of protein. What do you think about that?
I think it's an imperative, right? I really think that we don't have a lot of other options when we think about what the future, a sustainable future, is going to look like. And I think that entomophagy is one path, as Jenna mentioned, to really sustain human, you know, the human population growth that we're experiencing. And people have been eating even periodical cicadas, as the Haudenosaunee people in Onondaga. They famously had their crops destroyed in 1779 or around that time. I forget the exact year. And they were kind of forced to survive, as the story goes that Betty Lyons tells, they were forced to survive on periodical cicadas, and that actually prevented people from starvation. And I think, you know, we can look to examples from the past, we can look to present peoples that are consuming insects, and these people are surviving with this insect protein. And it seems like a good strategy to me. Plus, honestly, it's delicious. This is delicious. Like, I've eaten meat. I've been a vegetarian both. And I could tell you, insects are delicious.
Okay. You know, I once tried a grasshopper burger, essentially. And but in that case, though, I mean, it was grasshopper protein that had been ground down to kind of a flour. And so it didn't really have and then all sorts of spices were added to it. So it didn't really feel like I was eating something distinctly different, which I suppose was the goal of the company trying to make it for people who might be a little squeamish about the idea of eating insect protein. But it was great. I loved it. Now, speaking of history and indigenous peoples, we actually have a question from Barbara Broussal, who says, I'm hoping you'll talk about what indigenous people who were on the East Coast before 1633 thought about the cicadas. What do we know about that, Jessica?
Well, I live on Lenape territory in New Jersey, and I know that the Lenape have had different names, different words for annual and periodical cicadas. So there was already a distinction in their language. And like I mentioned, you know, there's records when early colonists and settlers from Europe arrived, they made notes in diaries and in documents that said that First Nations people were consuming cicadas when periodical cicadas came out. So there's this historical record plus oral tradition, like I mentioned, from the Onondaga of periodical cicadas being feasted on when crops were burned to kind of allow the Haudenosaunee tribal people to survive. So I think that for as long as there have been humans in the eastern United States, probably this has been on the menu. Mm-hmm. You know, periodical cicadas have been on the menu. And there's kind of this, I think, one thing that I found interesting reading historical documents, because I've kind of gone cicada manic the last few weeks, is that people in each document, as if it's the first time, describe the awe, the wonder, the fascination. You can eat them. There are going to be so many of them. There's going to be trillions. I mean, every person that seems to have documented this, from the oral tradition to the written tradition, seems to have noted just what a remarkable phenomenon this is.
I mean, a truly remarkable phenomenon. And a lot, there's so much interest in it this time around. I'm so delighted. Another listener wants to know, they live in rural Virginia. Living in rural Virginia, North Carolina, sometimes as a kid. I remember friends who had hunting dogs that were very aware something was happening beneath the soil around tree roots before the cicada emerged. Do you know anything about this? Could the dogs hear or smell, sense them somehow?
Well, certainly before the cicada nymphs actually, before you see them actually emerge and kind of crawl up the bark of trees, they make these little chimneys, they're called, or holes. And they look like holes kind of studying the soil. I actually have a bunch in my backyard right now. So listeners can go out and look to see if you have the holes. They're a bit wider than the diameter of a pencil. And so, you know, the nymphs actually are kind of backwards, sometimes often crawling backwards up out of these holes, or sometimes I've seen them, you know, face forward. So the dogs could be responding to that as well. You know, the scent of the cicadas, but then also there's movement, you know, because they're getting ready to come out.
Mm. And can you just describe for people who haven't seen this, when the nymphs come out, what do they look like?
Oh, I think they're stunning. So they're kind of amber colored. They have, like all insects, three sets of legs, and the front legs, or the forelegs as they're called, are modified for digging and clinging. So they have kind of hard, dark tissue that's called sclerotized, which is a fancy way of saying hardened tissue that's slightly darker in color. It almost looks like little spines. They can use this for digging, but then they can also use it to kind of cling to the bark of the trees when they're emerging from that last larval or nymphal skin. And their eyes are kind of beady, I suppose. And they have this rostrum, this mouth part that is the sucking mouth part that almost looks like a little bulbous ball in the front of their face that descends down into something that looks almost like a straw. And that's that piercing mouth part that they would pierce the roots with. And then in that rostrum, in that bulbous section, there's muscles that kind of allow them to do this sucking or pumping action to pump up that good, sweet xylem.
Okay. And then you said they molt several times as they crawl up the trees to the treetops. Do I have that right?
Well, no, just molt once, one final molt to adulthood. So they molt while they're in the juvenile stage in the soil as they're moving to the larger instar. But once they emerge, it's just a final molt to adulthood. So they emerge in this kind of last larval stadium or last nymphal stadium, crawl up the tree. And then the adult basically pulls its body out of this skin that gets left behind. And the name for that skin is an exuvia.
An exuvia. Did I say that right?
Yep, exuvia.
Exuvia. Wow. Well, we are talking about Brood 10, the periodical cicada that is about to emerge across the East Coast, parts of the East Coast and Midwest of the United States. A little later, we're going to hear about how cicadas are providing inspiration for music. This is On Point.
I'm interested in making music with animals and the sounds of animals in many different ways, because it helps connect me to the natural world. It helps me understand animals. And I, like many people, love trying to understand beings who are somehow outside of our normal world.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are reveling in the wonders of nature and what we have to learn from the emergence of the 17-year Brood 10 cicada. Trillions of insects, which are set to emerge from the ground any day now, we hope, in the eastern and midwestern United States. I'm joined today by Jessica Ware. She's an entomologist and associate curator in invertebrate zoology at the American Museum of Natural History. And Jessica, listen along with me because we want to hear about other ways in which the cicadas are inspiring folks. This is Mariana Aline, professor of entomology at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign.
I study bio-inspired design, where I look at insects to see if we can get any inspiration from them for new innovations.
For example, insects have inspired six-legged robots, robots that can jump. Termite mounds have inspired passive heating and cooling architectural design.
We decided to work on cicadas because certain research group in Australia had already found that cicada wings can be super hydrophobic, which means they repel water. Water cannot collect on it. And they may also be antimicrobial, that the structures on the wings actually kill microbes. So you can already see that combination of those two functions would be great to have on surfaces, on hospital, flat surfaces, or even in tubing. you know, what we think about now is respirators and such, so that microbes can't collect and water can't collect. We are now at the stage we've really studied the biology. We've really studied these different structures and different species of cicada, and we are now able to fabricate these structures, which means now the engineers in our collaborative group can now go into, okay, what can we make with this? What kind of materials can we make and implement in different applications? For me, the biologist, it's now really great to go sort of backwards along the bio-inspired design framework and go, okay, now I can make these different kinds of structures. I can make these different kinds of materials. How does that help me explain what I'm seeing in nature? Why has natural selection caused, you know, this cicada to give these kinds of structures or this species a different kind of structure, and why is that important? I'm still amazed that I actually study cicadas. I grew up in the Netherlands where they don't have cicadas. And then I moved to California where they have cicadas, but they're usually very small and in the desert. And I don't think I ever collected one when I worked on my insect collections as I was going to school there and studying there. Then when I moved to Illinois, they have a lot of cicadas here and I love them. For me, it is summer. It is being able to sit outside. They don't bother anybody. I really, really like them. It's one of my favorite parts of the Midwest for sure. A really good place to find periodical cicadas, no matter where it is cemeteries. Because in cemeteries, there's often trees that have been there for many 17-year periods. So you get really nice buildups of multiple occurrences of the emergences. So those trees have been there a long time. If there was an emergence there 17 years ago, there will probably be another emergence this year. So I, you know, get my kids in the car, we drive to a cemetery somewhere where I've heard that you can find periodicals, and then we just roam through the cemetery and try to find periodical cicadas.
Mariana Aline is a professor of entomology at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Well, Jessica Ware, how far beyond the strict study of the insects themselves do you know of how cicadas or insects are inspiring other researchers?
Well, I mean, I think cicadas have been fascinating to people just for the point of understanding sexual selection more broadly. I mean, what we're hearing when we hear those calls is actually a very complicated dance that has been selected for through a type of natural selection called sexual selection. So there are many researchers who are really interested in understanding how you can have sexual dimorphism, how you can have different behaviors in males and females, in birds, in lions, and what have you. But the fundamental principles for all of the studies is very similar to the fundamental principle of what's happening with these cicadas. So I think no matter what type of scientist you're talking to, whether it's someone who works on the kind of edges of engineering and medicine like Mariana, or whether it's someone who is a strict biologist, I think there's something that cicadas can inform us about the broader kind of phenomenons that are happening in our scientific disciplines. But it's not just science. I mean, it's art too. Mm-hmm. I mean, cicadas really are great templates for artistic practice, from the beautiful wings, from their coloration, from the noise that they're producing. All of these are terrific templates for an artistic vision.
Yeah, we're gonna hear about how they inspire a musician in a couple of minutes, but I do want to ask you just quickly one more question about the specific sort of local ecology of the emergence of brood 10. So they emerge, climb the trees, mate, lay eggs. The eggs then hatch into nymphs, and the nymphs fall down back down into the ground and nestle in the tree roots again. And that takes about 4 weeks or so, that period we're talking about.
Yeah, roughly. And it's, I mean, the nymphs, when they first hatch from these eggs, are very small, you know, like the size of a grain of rice. Uh-huh. And so they're falling, you know, 80 feet or 50 feet, however long, yeah. however far that, where they're falling. And then they're going to quickly and immediately kind of burrow down underneath the soil.
Is there a symbiotic relationship that the cicada has with the trees? Because I was, you know, we were talking about how they're, you know, they're eating the sap essentially of the trees. Do the trees get any benefit from that?
No, okay. So the trees don't get a benefit from it. And so we wouldn't really call it a symbiosis. Okay. However, as I mentioned, you know, when the cicadas die, they are kind of largely dying around the base of the trees. And that nutrition goes ultimately into the soil, okay. Which benefits the trees.
Okay. So then we still don't fully understand why it's 17 years in the case of brood 10 or other broods, which are, what, 13 years or so. I'm still marveled by the prime numbers. but what is it? What is the environmental trigger when the 17 years arrives that the cicadas are responding to that starts the emergence?
Well, so when the soil temperature reaches 64 degrees Fahrenheit, that is one of the environmental cues that nymphs use that kind of triggers their emergence. And so every time so what they think is happening is, you know, the quality and the content of the tree sap, of the xylem, is it varies with season. As we think of trees, we kind of expect that to be true. And so they're kind of taking these environmental cues of seasons over time. Plus there are these biochemical cascades, you know, of hormones inside their body that allow them to kind of tick off these different molting periods. And then if they're in the last instar, if the temperature of the soil is 64 degrees, if they have the right environmental cues and biochemical cascade of hormones inside their body, then boom, it's time for them to emerge.
So they are obviously, as a natural organism, very strongly tied to the environmental conditions around them. Do we know if climate change is having an impact on the cicada?
I think that researchers who study cicadas as their full-time kind of passion think that there is an impact already. Gene Kritsky notes that, you know, cicadas from this brood were emerging later on before 1950, and now they emerge early in May. So already the timing of when they're emerging just in this season has shifted slightly. And others, Chris Simon notes that maybe, you know, we're seeing, so sometimes you can have the timing be a little bit off and broods, some subset of the brood can emerge a little bit early or a little bit late because of they just can't read the environmental cues properly. She predicts that we might start seeing that happening more and more often, that you end up having these small stragglers, these small bursts of individuals that emerge early, which can be not a great strategy because without all of the chorus of other individuals with you, you're not able to do that satiation strategy, and they can quickly get picked off by predators. But some might somehow wondering whether, you know, the 13-year cicadas are just modified 17-year cicadas. Maybe in the future, will there be a 9-year cicada? You know, one thing that climate change might affect is the length of time the individuals are underground.
Mm. We've just got a couple of minutes left, about 2 minutes left here. Jessica, you know, a while ago, we talked to other entomologists who were concerned that there's mounting scientific evidence of, you know, kind of a global die-off of insects. Now, here we're talking about the emergence of trillions of cicada. But, I mean, I wonder, do you share that same concern? I mean, what do you see as the future of insect life on planet Earth?
I think we should all be really concerned, and we should take care to make sure that our actions have less impact on negative impact on insect populations. And we should work together as a team to try and document the insects that we have. Yes, there might be trillions of cicadas, but we know that there's already parts of the brood ranges that are going extinct. So there are citizen science efforts like the app Cicada Safari that people can download to their phones, and they can document where they're seeing cicadas. Because without that baseline data of where and how many insects we think we have in populations and where they're found, it's going to be really hard to make predictions. And it's going to be really hard to do the type of conservation work that we need to do to save the planet and to save insects.
Okay, so citizen science playing a key role here. And that app again, Cicada Safari, you said?
Cicada Safari.
Okay. Are there other ways for people to get involved?
Well, you can certainly contact your local entomology department, because I'm pretty sure all of the entomology departments are excited and going out to go and do cicada things. Everyone's talking about them. It's the hot thing for 2021.
Okay. So we've got some more comments coming in the last few seconds. Chengutai Halalo says, in Zimbabwe, we eat grasshoppers, grubs, crickets, termites, beetles, worms, and caterpillars, all very yummy. So that's just a taste, oh my God, pun not intended, of the great excitement from On Point listeners here as well over the course of this hour. So Jessica Ware, entomologist and associate curator in invertebrate zoology at the American Museum of Natural History, thank you so very much. And your excitement is infectious. And I hope you have a wonderful time as the cicada finally do emerge.
Thank you so much for having me. And I hope you enjoy the cicada time. This is a good year.
It's a great year, in fact. Well, folks, you've heard, we've been talking about the many different ways that we can appreciate Brood 10 or the cicadas more fully. But what about their song? We mentioned that before. So for that, we turned to David Rothenberg.
I'm a musician and philosopher and author and professor of philosophy and music at the New Jersey Institute of Technology. And I spend a lot of time making music with animals and their sounds.
Well, David plays with all kinds of animals, birds, whales, underwater pond life, and cicadas.
They fly all over the place. There's cicadas jumping on accordions, clarinets, fingers. At the very end, one flies into my eye, and I just have to laugh because, you know, they must be so fed up with us after all these hours.
Well, David says the joy he gets from making music with animals and cicadas began with an important lesson learned in his youth, how to listen.
I guess I was 6 years old. My parents decided we should move from New York City to Connecticut. We lived by this river, and I like to go out by myself and walk along there and listen to sounds and just sort of talk to myself and scheme and invent whole little worlds. And I started listening. And then I got a little older, I got interested in birds and identifying them, all the sounds they made. And then when I was in high school, I learned that not so far away was one musician who played saxophone with whales and wolves. And I learned about him and started to think I could do something like that. So cicadas are extremely loud, and they are making these sounds with timbales, the sides of their abdomen, vibrating them. So what makes it musical? It's the same sound over and over again. The males are doing it to attract some attention, and they perform it over and over and over again. So whoever decided this was called song throughout history must have recognized there's something like human song in that idea, that it's not talking or a call, but it's kind of a song. You just have this beautiful mix of sounds that is anything but random. It's organized. The strongest feeling when you're playing with cicadas is a sense of humility. You're just one sound among millions, literally millions of cicadas per acre. They make this huge hum, this huge rhythms. I'm just one more sound mixing into that. So you can't make yourself too much the center of the story. You're joining into something much larger than any individual could ever be. You also feel, I really feel my own sense of what music is expanding by spending so much time with these sounds. And then when you're done, you'll still be dreaming this frequency. These sounds are like deep inside your subconscious, and they don't go away, they're still there. And then when you hear them anew in the outside world, you say, ah, there it is again. We're part of these cycles. And so it feels like you're at the edge of something new and mysterious and magical. And I think it's great that these scientists, when they classified this organism already in the beginning of the 19th century, they said magicicada. We must call this magicicada. I definitely find when I do something new that I don't expect, when I do something new, there's always interesting surprises. And so it's important for me, even though you have less control and the sound might not be as perfect, to go out there in these environments of sound and figure out how your sound can join in. So the whole process is incredibly transforming to my own sense of what counts as music, what is music, what is not music, by just hanging out with these cicadas, spending time with them.
Musician and philosopher David Rothenberg. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.